Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Hello, everyone. I'm getting ready to do a test. Can you guys hear me? Okay, wonderful.
I'm Regina Vaidyanathan, and for the BBC World Service, I've been travelling across the United States to explore the issue of race in America. For a couple of years now, I've been covering the news as stories about race have risen up the agenda. But for this series, I've been taking a more detailed look back at this country's complicated racial history and forwards, meeting up with people who think they've found ways to finally heal some of this country's racial wounds.
Isn't that amazing? What a connection. What a connection.
I began my journey, and every episode, in Nicodemus in western Kansas. It's one of the country's last remaining black townships, a community founded in 1877 after slavery ended. Each year, the descendants of the original settlers meet for a reunion, celebrating the achievements of those who went before them.
Because he did things not too many black people would be able to do. And as a matter of fact, he almost...
A number of people from Nicodemus broke racial barriers in sport, becoming early black pioneers in major U.S. football leagues.
We just keep on making history.
History is important in this debate about race, not just in Nicodemus, but across America. For many people I've met during this journey, the only way to truly move forward is by fully acknowledging this country's fractious racial past, which they argue has laid the foundations for today's problems.
Because if you don't know your history, there's really no future. You got to go as his story. You got to keep telling his story. And his story was told way before we got here. And all we are is a carbon copy of them.
In this series, I've looked at some of the structural issues which impact racial divisions in the US. I've already examined housing, education, employment, and policing. But underlying all the conversations in these very different areas, there's been a theme. How do people from different races interact with and understand each other? And because so many Americans don't interact with one another, in this final episode, I'll be looking at how the black experience and blackness itself is presented and represented.
I like who I am. Regardless, I like who I am. So we're a reflection of our elders.
And representation matters so much because it's how Americans see one another. That's something I discuss with Lewis and Nicole Anderson, whose family have featured throughout this series.
What happened was the extremist stereotype has become the reality. And now you'll see more African Americans in that stereotype than you will see normal, everyday African-American culture. You know, if we're not looking like the worst person on the planet, you won't see us on TV. You won't see us in a positive light, in my opinion. I can't relate to certain entertainers. It's not how I live. It's not how my husband looks or acts. And unfortunately, if you're a person who does not live near an African-American, that is the only image you have. Growing up in America, my father used to tell us, being that we came from a wealthy background and we were going to all-white schools, he would tell us that you have to represent your race. Everywhere you go, you may be the only African-American that a schoolmate will ever meet. So what you say, what you do matters, because there's somebody else who they may encounter later on in life who is going to be impacted based upon how you are perceived at school, at work, at church.
You might remember the on-stage celebratory fist bump between me and my husband after a primary win that was referred to as a terrorist fist jab.
What's the price for a black man life? I check the toe tag, not one zero in sight. I turn the TV on, not one hero in sight, unless he dribble or he fiddle with mics.
Those ways of portraying race affect people even at the highest level. And in early 2015, the First Lady Michelle Obama spoke to graduates at a majority black university about the stereotypes she says her and her husband face.
And my husband and I know how frustrating that experience can be. We've both felt the sting of those daily slights throughout our entire lives. The folks who crossed the street in fear of their safety, the clerks who kept a close eye on us in all those department stores, the people at formal events who assumed we were the help, and those who have questioned our intelligence, our honesty, even our love of this country.
I've had conversations like this with so many people across the US. And while some argue that the reaction to President Obama's election has shown how far America still has to go, others remain more optimistic about the symbolism of a black family in the White House. Amongst those is the artist Kehinde Wiley.
You can create an aesthetics of oppression. And what does that mean? It means that your every utterance is coming from the periphery. You're assuming that you stand on the outside of culture, conversation, power, democracy. Increasingly, as young people recognize this broader evolution in American culture, they see themselves at the center. And if you see someone who looks like you in a position of power, it, by virtue of symbol, says that the periphery has become the center.
There are more multidimensional, less stereotypical black role models in popular culture, in films and TV, but many argue more still needs to be done. And the reason I went to meet Kehinde is because he has a fascinating answer to the question, how?
You can't force people to feel something that they don't, but art can. Art can sneak in there and give you an opportunity to feel something that you wouldn't naturally feel. These paintings are designed certainly to be easy on the eye. That's the Trojan horse.
So for Kehinde, art is a way of changing perceptions subconsciously. I met him at his studio in New York's hipster capital, Brooklyn. In a high-ceilinged warehouse, his art filled the walls in various states of completion. The paintings were bright, bold, and arresting.
I have very large-scale equestrian portraits here. Some of the people riding these horses are complete strangers who I've met in the streets of Brooklyn, but also in far-flung places like villages in Cameroon and Nigeria.
And there's one thing about all of the characters that's unique about these portraits.
Well, they're all black men. This body of work focuses specifically on the representation of people of color.
Kehinde's portraits, set on a background of a William Morris-inspired wallpaper, reimagine traditional art, the work of old masters in new hands. They're mesmerizing, and I couldn't stop staring.
This work is a response to history. All of these erect, proud, dominant figures that you see on these horses were white men, and now they're not. The optimism that existed in the original object, that unquestioned, unbridled sense of dignity and providence, is being hijacked. Is it true? This is a site of art. It's a place where the possible and the factual and the historical all collide, and it gives you an opportunity to see things in a slightly different way.
And if there ever was an example of someone who wanted their life to mirror art, that would be you in these works.
That would be me.
There's one other important contribution Kehinde's art makes to the debate about black identity, and that's its variability. Because, of course, being black in America covers a huge swathe of different people, just as being white or Latino or Asian does. And studying this variability is just what Christina Greer, an academic at Fordham University in New York City, did for her book Black Ethnics. She found some fascinating differences between the attitudes of what she calls JBs, just blacks, African Americans like herself, descendants of slavery with no immigrant identity, and the new black immigrants.
Caribbeans, and now I found that Africans, will maintain their last name or maintain their accent or some sort of cultural signifier so that employers and other people will know that they're not JBs. And so you would think, okay, well, there's these distinctions between black ethnic groups, but what I found in my book is that both race and ethnicity matter for Black people in this country. And so, yes, on the one hand, you have Caribbeans and Africans maintaining this ethnic identity, but there are many circumstances where they realize they are also just Black like everyone else. It's something about the Black phenotype that prevents them from getting that job that other non-Black immigrants seem to get. And so they find themselves in this racialized space. And so if a police officer decides to shoot you or your child, they're not going to say, like, stop, are you Ghanaian?
Christina argues that this is the first time in American history that immigrants are actively trying to maintain their immigrant identity rather than integrate into American society. She asked Africans and Afro-Caribbeans about their feelings towards the United States and compared them with the views of Black Americans. Christina's JBs.
What I found was Africans were definitely the most optimistic group, but Black Americans were in the middle, and Afro-Caribbeans were the least optimistic. And in interviewing Black Americans, essentially the phrase, you win some, you lose some, came up quite often. Whereas Afro-Caribbeans were the least optimistic because they argued that they came here at the same time as non-Black immigrants, and they see the circumstances and the life chances of these other non-Black immigrants way above their own. And they essentially realized it's their phenotype, it's their Black skin.
Come on. I see no changes. Wake up in the morning and I ask myself, is life worth living? Should I blast myself? I'm tired of being poor and even worse, I'm Black. My stomach hurts.
One recent poll suggested that just a third of Americans think race relations are good. A 20-year low. And perhaps that shouldn't come as a surprise. As I found in the last episode, integration's still limited. Despite the successes of the civil rights movement, many Americans don't get to know one another in their daily lives, which is why so many people are so focused on what's being taught in US schools. Khalil Muhammad is director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, based in New York City. He's written about how the perception of Black people as dangerous criminals has come about in his book, The Condemnation of Blackness. He also has a teenage son.
One of the things that I'm conscious of is how much exposure does he have to Black literature and history. Usually it's packaged in a particular time of year, around February, not always, but mostly. It ranges in topic, but one of the things he said, unsolicited by me, was that we read multiple genres of writing about the German Holocaust every single year, and we've been doing it over and over again. That surprised me, because I just didn't expect the investment in that history to be so significant in an American public school. And that reminds me, even in a very personal way, that our schools make choices about what's important, what do we need to impart. And in this way, African American history and literature is optional in too many instances.
This experience reminded me of a conversation I had with a white pastor in Louisiana who said that while there is, and should be, a memorial to the Holocaust in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., there still isn't a national memorial to slavery. And for Khalil, a deeper education in Black history is sorely needed. He mentioned a study conducted across all 50 American states in 2011 which looked at how the civil rights movement is taught in schools.
Out of 50 states, 35 states fail by this analysis, mostly measuring on a scale how robust was the teaching required on civil rights history. Turns out that of the 35 states who failed by that analysis, 16 of them required no teaching of civil rights history. So the politics of knowledge are always a factor in the contemporary debate about racial inequality or justice. And there is robust state administrative data to show that in moments of backlash against social movements in this country, sites of history learning and teaching were subject to state surveillance and backlash. So even to this day, authors such as Toni Morrison and James Baldwin and Ralph Ellison are banned in certain parts of this country.
It was a comic book that inspired me.
Another person troubled by what he sees as a lack of teaching about Black history and culture is John Lewis, who as a student and civil rights leader marched alongside Dr. Martin Luther King from Selma to Montgomery. Now a congressman, he's adapted his story to a different medium, graphic novels, as a way of reaching young people.
The graphic novel, March, in my estimation, is one of the best ways to get the story told to all children. All children must know this story. It doesn't matter whether they're black or white, Latino, Asian American, Native American. They must understand the whole America, and we must teach our children the whole story.
Oh, oh, freedom. Oh.
But to develop empathy, stories needn't be true. And the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, Tracy K. Smith, who's recently written a memoir of her life, argues that literature can play a particularly important role in schools.
I'll be buried in my grave.
Literature is something that's really powerful because the intimacy that a book fosters between you, whoever and wherever you are, and whoever is speaking to you, it's almost more effective than the intimacy that we might allow ourselves to kind of sink into in real time. And I don't think that is fake. I don't think it's something that disappears once the book gets shut. I really believe that curricula in schools can foster a little bit more willingness to look at the other without turning away and to say, I wonder, you know, what that might have felt like. And I wonder if there's any way in which I've felt something like that, you know, and so that the next time you're in a situation where you're able to act, you know, and decide, am I going to scoot over in the subway seat and turn away and hide behind my newspaper? Or am I going to just look at this person and acknowledge them? Am I going to imagine, you know, why this might be what they're doing or this might be where they're going? I feel like those little small exercises in seeing, acknowledging, and understanding can change the way that we relate to people.
And Tracy says being able to relate to one another requires people from different racial backgrounds to have different types of conversation.
The probability of extreme discomfort and bad mistakes, misunderstanding, I feel like it's a process, and it's something that you learn to do and you learn to become comfortable within. And there's not a vocabulary. I think one of the things that inhibits people from even entering into these kinds of conversations is the idea, oh, but there's this correct vocabulary that I'm supposed to use and I can't talk about what I really think. And I feel like courtesy is something that should be encouraged, you know, broadly. But nuance is more interesting than courtesy, I think, and it's more productive. And nuance, to me, is something that can come only from honesty, right? This is what I think. Am I wrong? This is what I fear. If I say that, how does that make you feel? And, you know, these tiny, clunky, awkward steps are really necessary. And if we can force ourselves to really grapple with difficult terms, then we might actually reap really interesting rewards, which is something that's impossible if we're hiding behind politeness and if we're recoiling from discomfort.
So experiencing discomfort is okay. It's okay. It's part of the
If she's right, how could Americans get those conversations started? How do they stop recoiling from discomfort, as she put it?
And again, when we're talking about race in particular, often there's a tendency not to want to feel that discomfort. Oh my God, we're uncomfortable. Let's just stop.
At a hotel in Baltimore, Andrea Johnson speaking to a room packed with people, including many teachers who've come from across America to talk about and learn how to talk about race. The course is called Courageous Conversations About Race. It was designed by Glenn Singleton.
We are way disproportionate based on the demographics in schools. So approaching or exceeding 80% of our teachers are white in the United States. In some schools, you'll find 90%, sometimes 100% of the educators are white. And so with a quickly approaching student of color majority in most states, our most populous states already there, this disproportionality is a challenge because not only can educators often not talk about race effectively, but they also don't have the consciousness to reveal the racial nuances that are going on. Some very basic things like, you know, why is the student looking, feeling, you know, acting this way? And that kind of conversation needs to be worked out. And so you're going to not only see in the advanced seminars where those beliefs have been transformed, so they're not arguing whether race matters, for example. And so to some degree, we have to be able to not take this so personally so that we can address the larger issue, you know, the structures.
On one hand, I have people who are white, who just by appearance represent some things to me in my experience as a black woman. Some hurt, some pain, some oppression. And on this other side, I have this space and this firm belief around race and around seeing others' humanity and around this real...
The conversations get very intense and very personal. For some, it's about being brave and honest with their own biases and perceptions, not something everyone is comfortable doing. I met some participants who found that part exceptionally challenging, but rewarding. And it's not just teachers. Glenn now has a growing number of corporate clients. I asked him why companies should be doing this.
Well, everybody should be doing it, because what we see in corporate America are we see people who have been miseducated around race. But nonetheless, people grow up to be CEOs without ever asking very basic questions about their own racial experience, let alone the racial experience of their employment. And so the reason that this is critical across the sectors is all of those sectors come from the same U.S., which has this history of racial injustice. They all function in a society today which have these persistent racial disparities. And the result of that is an economic challenge for the country, because we are not bringing the larger and growing populations into their full possibility because they're not educated, they're not skilled. And so when we interrupt that, we actually create a much larger and much more vibrant workforce.
Many people I've spoken to throughout this journey say the only lasting way to interrupt and change the conversation is by ensuring there's better representation of black Americans in leadership roles. And that comes by more people voting and electing people of colour. But to so many people I've met, that's not enough. They want grassroots change of the kind last seen during the civil rights era. Back then, they had leaders, figures of national and international stature, like Dr. Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. Today, the movement has no figureheads, and the social network of the church has been replaced by social media. At every protest I've covered, whether it's Ferguson or Baltimore, I've met activists marching for justice, carrying a phone to live stream and record. And so while I was in Kansas, I paid a visit to One Struggle KC, a group who organised through and met through the internet.
I think what happens is people want to make a difference and want to see actual change happen, and they want to get involved. You know, social media definitely plays a very, very key role in that, because that's how I hooked up with a lot of the people here. You know, Britt and I went down to Ferguson. Our friend was talking about Ferguson on Facebook and was like, we should go. And we got together, called full of people, and we went.
Yeah. We had Martin Luther King, we had Malcolm X, we had all of these great people who were murdered, okay? But if we are all asserting ourselves as leaders in this movement, you cannot kill all of us.
It's not a leader-less movement, it's a leader-full movement. And I think, you know, myself and Kristen, we both went to the Movement for Black Lives in Cleveland, and it was so affirming to see the central piece of it were young people. But also that the most marginalized communities within the black community are also leading this. That there are queer people, that there are women. I'd say 60% of the people there were women. That there are trans folks that are leading this movement. And until you liberate the most marginalized within your community, not everyone's going to be free. And I think that's a major shift in this part of the movement, is that we tend to think of civil rights leaders, Al Sharpton, straight, black, older, faith-based. And this is all of us. And you can't just have a few people, because you're going to shut people out. That's what happens.
Whether it will take a movement to heal America's racial wounds, and whether this is the movement to do so, nobody can tell. But what I've learned in this programme is that everyone from every racial background must be part of the conversation. This idea has been talked about before. In 1963, the celebrated black writer James Baldwin described the need to create a dual consciousness between races. If that happened, he wrote, we may be able, handful that we are, to end the racial nightmare and achieve our country and change the history of the world.
God gave another rainbow sign. No more water but fire next time. Pharaoh's army.
Echoing an old spiritual song, he went on to warn that without it, it would be the fire next time. And many believe that fire's already been lit. As I watched buildings burn in Ferguson, the words of one mother surely stuck in my mind. If we didn't have violence, no one would have paid attention, she told me. Well, now the world's watching. And many people I've met in this series, from policymakers to poets, artists to activists, face a real challenge. Can they use this fire to generate positive change, or will it burn out of control?
Pharaoh's army got drowned.
America in Black and White on the BBC World Service was presented by me, Regina Vaidyanathan. The producer was Giles Edwards.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.